Hi, I'm Naomi.
And I'm Kaylee.
Coming at you from the traditional unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. And this is...
Sorry, Murder.
Listener discretion is advised.
For this week, I, Kaylee, have prepared a story, and Naomi does not know what that story is. It's going to be a surprise. For trigger warning, this is a warning for anyone, really. This story involves the death of two children. All right, let's get started. So, I shouldn't sound so happy. Let's get started. This case begins in Surrey, BC. Surrey is a city in the Vancouver regional area. And the story begins in the late 70s, early 80s. It will also span through the 90s and go right up to today when we have current updates. So don't be quick to dismiss this as an old story. There's twists, there's turns.
Ooh.
One last note, I'm going to refer to Tomas Yebes as Mr. Yebes so as not to confuse him with his son, Tommy. Tomas Yebes was born in Madrid, and he moved to Canada in the fall of 1967 for a woman he would later say liked him a lot when they met in Spain, but in Canada, she realized she didn't like him so much. So they broke up. But he stayed here, and he learned to speak English, and he met a woman named Elvira.
I love that name.
It's awesome. And Elvira had moved here from Switzerland in the spring of 1968. So Elvira and Mr. Yebes married that very year, and they built a home in Surrey. Mr. Yebes worked as a hairstylist and a wig maker, and he became co-owner of a business. In 1971 and 73, Mr. and Mrs. Yebes had two daughters. Mr. Yebes kept working, and his wife stayed home to be a stay-at-home mom. The two of them had big hearts. They found themselves feeling particularly concerned with the plight of young children in poorer countries of the world, and they began to consider an international adoption. They wanted to give children a better chance at life in a stable country. So, in 1977, they began the lengthy process of adopting two boys from Chile. Finally, in 1979, the two boys were brought to Canada to live with the Yebes family. The boys were named Gabriel, born in 1974, and Yurko, who they renamed Tommy, was born in 1975. So when Gabriel and Tommy joined the Yebes family, they were 4 and 5 years old.
Oh,
so sweet. I don't know if there was adoption education back then. Currently, in Canada, I know from personal experience, the adoption process is lengthy, and a big part of it is a course and like a home study, but in the course you learn all about child behavior, the grief and loss they go through with adoption, and the adjusting stages, which can take years. With this story, I really wonder if the Yebes had that, because right away, they began to say that the boys did not fit into the family and the new home as readily as they had expected.
I wonder if there was education made available to the family before the adoption, because it was just, people didn't know.
Exactly. Yeah, and like even now, they try to inform parents that for years and years, you might think this isn't working, and then it will click. But that's part of the process for a lot of children, because it's such a big change, and they've gone through so much loss. So they didn't fit in, and Mrs. Yebes complained of difficulties with the boys, because they would not comply with the rules she had established for the family. Mr. Yebes thought his wife was too strict with the boys. And these differences in parenting led to more and more conflict between the husband and wife. They were disagreeing on parenting styles, and finally, in 1981, they themselves went to a psychiatrist to kind of see if some professional assistance could help them resolve their problems. Right about the time that the adoption was actually formalized, which is a time that the family should be celebrating, Mrs. Yebbies decided that she could no longer tolerate these two boys. And the couple agreed to separate for a period of 3 to 6 months and kind of see how they felt after that.
That must have been so confusing for the kids.
Oh, exactly. And then the little ones, I'm imagining blaming themselves, like coming to this new home and the new home is falling apart.
And then the parents fall apart.
Exactly. All right, so the agreement was that Mrs. Yebbies would stay in the family home with their two biological daughters. And Mr. Yebbies would move with the two boys into a townhouse in town that was only a short distance away from the rest of the family, and he would rent that. Mr. Yebbies took responsibility for the boys. He was paying rent on the townhouse, as well as the mortgage for the house that Mrs. Yebbies was in. He was paying the bills for both households, which is like, I mean, these things add up. He took good care of the boys. He was preparing their meals. He was making sure that they attended school. He was arranging to get them to daycare when he was at work. And that's not easy. Looks like he's doing great. Meanwhile, Mrs. Yebbies used their savings to keep herself and the girls maintained. And throughout the separation, the entire family continued to get together regularly, which I think is really nice. They had family dinners together, and they would get the kids together to play together and to visit together.
Is it bad that I just don't like Elvira? Like, she just sounds like a villain. I mean, I wonder how she was raised, because it sounds like she, like, the authoritative part and everything. Like, I just wonder if her parents were strict, too, and I can't help but not like her.
I know, I feel the same way, and it feels like she gave up on them. We have such little information on her, other than she's from Switzerland, and so...
Aren't they so nice in Switzerland?
That's what I was thinking!
Have chocolate.
I know. So they would get together, you know, and the family would try to keep seeing one another and having these dinners and stay connected. And Mr. and Mrs. Yebbies said that they both wanted to end the separation. They wanted to get back together. You're going to love this. But Mrs. Yebbies said she was still apprehensive about the boys. She did not feel that she could live in a house with them, and she wanted them to be readopted.
What?
I know, it's harsh.
They're not pets. Like, they're not pets. You can't do that. I mean, if they don't fit in, look at what's not working in your household. Don't look at what's not working in, like, they're just children.
100%. So actually, Mr. Yebbies, he's getting pushed into a corner. In 1982, he actually called social workers and he made some inquiries about readoption. However, he was informed that there would be major delays and that readoption was a really lengthy process and he would still have the boys for quite some time. And so it didn't really seem like a realistic option. So he asked a social worker if they could write him a letter saying that the boys could not be readopted. That wasn't even an option, because he wanted to give that letter to Mrs. Yebbies and say, look, you're stuck with them, you know, and hope that could persuade her to come back and let the family be reunited.
I love him.
So they had been separated almost 6 months, and Mr. Yebbies knew that pretty quickly he'd have to be moving back in with his wife because his lease was going to expire on the townhouse, and this was just very expensive, having this trial separation. On February 7th, 1982, there's record of Mr. Yebbies calling the police because there had been an out-of-control fire in the boys' bedroom. The boys said someone had come in and lit the fire.
Stop.
Yeah. But when the police officer arrived, he found a candle in the bedroom and evidence that there had been a fire started there. And the boys kept explaining, you know, someone did this. They said there was a monster who had been in the room. The officer examined the premises and he found no evidence of entry through any doors or windows. He examined outside and on the fence where an intruder could have gone up into a window. The frost on the fence was not disturbed in any way, so he concluded that the boys were kind of just making up a lie. They had been playing with fire, and they said someone came in and did it, but it was likely just the boys that played with fire. At that time, the boys were put into separate bedrooms because they had been sharing a bedroom, but they were just getting into all kinds of trouble with the fire, and then the older boy was telling the younger boy scary stories. They weren't going to sleep. One boy stayed upstairs, and one boy got moved into a utility room downstairs.
Oh my god.
Mr. On February 23rd, 1982, Mr. and Mrs. Yebes planned for a supper for the whole family at the townhouse. Mr. Yebes picked up the boys at daycare at 6 p.m., and he took them to the townhouse. Mrs. Yebes and the two girls arrived at about 6:10 p.m. The family had supper at about 6:30, and then Mr. and Mrs. Yebes went into the bedroom, and they talked for half an hour. They talked about their separation and about the whole situation they were facing. Mr. Yebes later states that that night, quote, "I told my wife that we have to come back together. The reason for it was that I told her financially we cannot stay separate. I could not support two households for much longer. I told her that there was no way. We had to come together." And she started to cry. And she got mad, upset, but she calmed down. And she did give me the impression that she accepted what I told her. Thereafter, we came down. And he means down in the bedroom. Mm-hmm. With their discussion, they're deciding something's got to give. And they do want to be together.
I wouldn't want to be with her. She sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, you're not wrong. So the two boys went to bed at that point, and Mrs. Yebes and the two daughters left the townhouse at 8 p.m. At that time, Tommy, the younger, was sleeping in an upstairs bedroom, which adjoined Mr. Yebes' bedroom. And Gabriel, the little older, 1 year older, boy, was sleeping downstairs on a mattress in a small utility room. Mr. Yebes said that he went to bed at about 10 p.m. in his main room upstairs. He put on a stereo headset with a long cord running downstairs to the stereos. So I guess it's like headphones with like a really long cord. I'm just grateful for wireless headphones today.
That's so old school.
So when he wanted to change his music, he had to go downstairs.
Oh my God.
and which is what he did at about 10:45. He went downstairs to change the tape that he was listening to. Then he went back up to his bedroom, put on his headset, and fell asleep. But he was awakened by a strange noise. Thinking it was one of the boys going to the bathroom or one of the neighbors in the adjoining townhouse, he just went back to sleep. But then he was awoken a second time by the smell of smoke. He rushed downstairs to see if it was caused by his pipe that he had earlier had, and he discovered a room full of smoke. He went right into the thick smoke, into the utility room where Gabriel was supposed to be sleeping. He pushed open the door, and inside, he saw both the boys laying on the mattress, burning.
No!
They were covered by a blanket, and it appeared as if they had made no move to escape.
Oh my God.
He pulled one of the boys out of the bed and noticed that the boy's body was stiff and lifeless.
Jesus.
He burned his hands trying to get him out of the bed. Then he called the police. The police call was received by Sergeant Shaw of the RCMP at 1 a.m. that night, and within minutes, the sergeant arrived at the townhouse.
Because the younger one was upstairs in the adjoining bedroom when Mr. Yevers went to sleep, essentially, or was falling asleep listening to the headset. So how did he get downstairs?
Yeah, good question. When Sergeant Shaw arrived, Mr. Yebes was at the window on the second floor of the building shouting, "In here! In here!" The police officer entered through the front door, which was closed but not locked. Apparently, Mr. Yebes stayed upstairs and made no attempt at all to open the front door for the officer. So the assumption was that he knew the door was unlocked. Sergeant Shaw proceeded up a flight of stairs to the second level in the living room, which was filled with smoke. He at once saw one of the boys laying outside of the door of the utility room. The boy was obviously dead. He looked into the utility room and saw the second boy, also dead, laying face down on the mattress. The mattress was still on fire with flames shooting up. While the officer was making his observations, Mr. Yebes was on the telephone speaking to his wife, and Sergeant Shaw heard him say, "They're dead. They're dead." Another police officer arrived, followed by firemen who extinguished the fire on the mattress. An officer observed that Mr. Yebes was confused and seemed detached. Mrs. Yebes then arrived, and she spoke to Mr. Yebes for about 10 minutes. Following this conversation, Mr. Yebes was escorted to a police car in order to make a statement. After the statement, Mr. Yabes informed the officer that his hands and feet had been burned in an attempt to rescue the boys, so he was taken to the hospital for treatment. As the scene was investigated, the police found a dry bloodstain permeating the bedding in the bed where Tommy slept. So that's the upstairs bedroom.
Weird.
Not the one where the fire was. Later, tests revealed the blood was consistent with Tommy's blood type. They also found a damp stain in the bed, which was suspected to be urine, but it was never tested. They didn't have the equipment at that time in the laboratory to test for urine. Back downstairs in Gabriel's room, where the two boys had been found, where the fire took place, the police discovered a butane lighter. The lighter was open in a position which allowed the gas to escape. When they tested the lighter, it sparked, but it did not make a flame. They then filled it with butane from a container in the living room and tested it again. This time, it ignited immediately, and it produced a 6-inch flame. When the lighter was shown to Mr. Yabes, he acknowledged that it was his lighter, but he stated that it did not work, and it had not worked for a long time. He explained that the lighter leaked butane gas, and so normally it would become empty just half an hour after it being filled with butane. The police interviewed Mr. and Mrs. Yabes at the station. Mr. Yabes was distraught, and he became more and more upset throughout the interview. When a police officer told him that the evidence indicated the boys had not died from the fire, Mr. Yabes completely broke down. Because of this evidence, Mr. Yabes was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder for each of the boys. And court proceedings took place.
I don't think he did it.
It's tough, though, because people can put on a really good exterior.
They put on a good show?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. My spidey senses are tingling. Like, I just don't think it was him. The blood on the mattress is weird, though. Like, And that's super interesting that they didn't have the right technology to test for urine. Like, it just shows how far crime scenes have come from that in forensics, but...
Yeah, the crime scene investigation. However, it's funny you say that because we're going to talk a lot more about how things have progressed. At trial, a fire expert was called to give evidence on the cause of the fire, and he concluded that the fire had been deliberately set. He testified upon the burn patterns, and he said that it was lit in multiple locations, and that an accelerant was used, such as gasoline. Further expert evidence clearly proved that the two boys had died before the fire. They conducted some tests by starting a fire in the small utility room and burning a mattress under controlled conditions. And these tests indicated that the fire on February 23rd would have produced large quantities of carbon monoxide, hydrogen cyanide, and soot within just a few minutes of starting. Yet toxicologists examined blood taken from the boys and did not find abnormal levels of these things in their blood. So there wasn't carbon monoxide, hydrogen cyanide. They didn't find anything abnormal. They also didn't see signs of other poisons or drugs. An autopsy was performed. The pathologists examined the mouths, throats, and lungs of the children and found no evidence, again, of carbon particles or staining. He also found no evidence of searing or singeing inside the bodies, which would be consistent with a death caused by a flash fire. Based on his findings, the toxicologist concluded that the boys must have been dead before the fire started. Although, at the same time, they could not rule out fire as a cause of death. He could not determine the exact cause of death due to the condition the bodies were in. They were badly burned up on the outside.
These older cases, there's just so much confusion, and like sometimes when I'm reading these, I'm like, I could do the job.
I know. I'm super confused because this is verbatim from the evidence offered by the toxicologist, and it says that they didn't see singeing and searing consistent with a flash fire, and then it also says the bodies were too badly burnt up to tell the real cause of death. So I think they're referencing the inside and the outside of the bodies, but it's really muddled. So basically, they can't conclusively say anything. There was no evidence to even suggest that the boys could have died of natural causes, but they couldn't rule that out as a possibility. It was believed that the state of the bodies could be consistent with death by asphyxiation. They also attempted to estimate the time of death by examining stomach contents. They said it was unlikely that the boys could even have been alive 4 to 6 hours after the last meal. So that could put them time of death at being like 10 p.m., which I guess is when Mr. Yebe said he was still awake. There is one further piece of evidence which should be noted. At trial, Mr. Yebe was asked whether or not he had locked his front door the evening the boys died. Mr. Yebe replied that while he could not specifically recall locking the door that night, he locked the door every night, and so he believed that it would have been locked that night as well. He was asked if he had unlocked the door at any time, and he said no. So from this evidence, one would have expected the front door to be locked when Sergeant Shaw arrived, and yet it was unlocked. And Mr. Yebe made no effort to come downstairs, to make sure it was unlocked. So they found this to be very suspicious. The trial only lasted 2 weeks. On September 13th, 1983, the jury returned the verdict, guilty of 2 counts of second-degree murder. Although Mr. Yebe had by all accounts been an affectionate father who appeared to be genuinely interested in the welfare of his 2 sons, the jury felt that the crime scene pointed to him as being guilty, and that he had murdered them. So actually, you're not the only one who had an issue.
I have with lots this finding. Of issues.
So they appealed this verdict. And in 1987, so he's been in prison a while now, they reopened the case, and this time they raised the point that Mrs. Yebe was never, ever called to testify.
Yeah, what was her... I was just thinking about, like, what is her alibi? And also, like, why are we not talking about the blood?
Very good questions. They never called Mrs. Yebe to even testify in court, and she wasn't looked into as a suspect. They raised the issue that she had just as much motive, if not more, to harm the boys.
Exactly. And she also has a key, so there wouldn't be a forced entry if the door was unlocked.
Mm-hmm. Yet again, the Court of Appeal believed that Mr. Yebe had exclusive opportunity to commit the crime. And the original decision, they said, was not unreasonable. So Mr. Yebe returned to jail. After that verdict, though, Mr. Yebe made the statement. He said, "I would beg the police not to close this case. To not only use circumstantial evidence, but please use feelings and sensitivity. I understand it's hard work, but I beg." He then turned to the prosecutor and continued, "I also realize you are doing your job. And although I know you have made a mistake, I hold no animosity. To my friends, they believe me. I beg them not to lose their faith, because the truth will come out. I am innocent." So Mr. Yebe went back to jail, and he spent about 10 years there before being eligible for parole. Now, it's bad enough going to jail when people think you've harmed children.
10 years. With all of those crazy people that just want to hurt you because they think that you've harmed small children.
Mm-hmm. That's got to be scary. And the other thing that's not working out really in his favor is refusing to admit guilt. This can be a serious problem when you go in front of the parole board. They want you to take responsibility, and talk about change. And a person who does not accept responsibility can be seen as someone who's not sorry. They're not taking ownership of the offenses that they're convicted of, and they're often denied parole. Because of this, people who maintain their innocence tend to remain in custody far longer than if they admitted to a crime, meaning that people who might be wrongfully convicted can serve a longer time in jail than people who are guilty.
That's such a double-edged sword. I mean, I know, like, the stigma is that, like, everyone in jail is innocent, but there actually are innocent people that are wrongly convicted, especially with, like, these types of cases that just never get reopened. Mm-hmm. So I have feelings for them, and yeah, I think it's a double-edged sword, because if you are guilty, then you're saying that you did it, and mm-hmm. then you're put away for life. But then if you're not guilty, and you don't say you did it because you want to maintain your, like, I don't know.
It's tough. There's no right answer, and I agree with you. People who are in prison, a lot of people, they're going to say, "I didn't do it."
Yeah.
Or have another reason. But then you have to accept guilt sometimes to get a lesser sentence and to get parole. I think it's, is it the Alford plea where you're saying you're innocent, but you recognize there's enough evidence to say that you did it? And so it's kind of like admitting, not guilt, but some acceptance. Mr. Yebes was a model inmate. Although he continued to profess his innocence, he was finally paroled in 1996. Although he was out, he still wanted his name to be cleared. This is understandable, as newspapers ran headlines such as, "Killer Dad Walks Free." Not to mention trying to get a rental, trying to get a job. You know, people are often checking your record. And who's going to rent to someone if they think you killed your children?
That's... You could work in a bowling alley and that's it. Just a bowling alley.
Maybe not, because children bowl. Okay, so in this story, once again, family comes through strong. Mr. Yebes had a nephew, and his name was Tarek Elenwehi. When Gabriel and Tommy died, Tarek was just a small child as well. But as he grew up, Tarek had always believed that his uncle was innocent. And he even became a lawyer with the goal to help his uncle clear his name. Law school, that's no easy feat. I'd like to give him a pat on the back for that. And when he finished, he went on to join the Innocence Project to clear his uncle's name. But the big question remained, how would they prove he was innocent? As the lawyers began re-examining the case 3 decades later, they were struck by a staggering question. What if the children's deaths were not murder at all? They formed some new arguments. Here they are. Gabriel's mattress was made from a material called kapok, a vegetable material that's so combustible it can burn underwater.
Weird.
Yeah, super weird. Kapok was prone to flameless combustion as well, so this means that it could smolder for hours, incinerating itself without ever really becoming inflamed. Because kapok depletes oxygen in the area around it, it is highly dangerous in enclosed spaces.
So I guess that all they have to do is prove that there was other ways of these children to die for him to be cleared of his name. So I guess they just have to get like really creative, even though I have strong feelings that it was Elvira.
Interesting. So as we know, Gabriel and Tommy were in a very small room. And that tiny room also had the water heater in it as well. So we don't know what kind of effect that could have had, but we do know that the mattress was made from kapok. Secondly, using stomach contents to establish a time of death was already known as a bit of a shaky science in the 1980s. And it's only become more delegitimized lately. There really were serious questions raised about the time of death, and they argued you can't rely on stomach contents.
I just want to know about the blood. Like, what about the blood? Why is no one talking about the blood?
It's funny you say that, because that's one of my biggest questions as well. I'm wondering if maybe Tommy woke up because he had a nosebleed or something.
So you're kind of saying that perhaps Tommy had a nosebleed and then went downstairs to go hang out with his brother. That's where the blood came from. And then because of the mattress, the kapok, it killed them. And then it combusted and then a fire started. And that's kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, it makes sense to me because they proved that kapok sucks the oxygen out of the air. So that would be why they didn't find the chemicals consistent with breathing in smoke in the boys' blood tests. And so I'm thinking it makes sense that they would have passed out just from not having enough oxygen. Mm-hmm. If this thing is smoldering in their mattress, perhaps, and they don't even see flames at that point. Mm-hmm. Let's keep reading their arguments here. Thirdly, it has also come to light that fire pattern science, or whatever it's called, has been subject to investigator bias. And understanding patterns is largely dependent on the investigator's knowledge, experience, education, training, and skill. It's not always guaranteed you're going to get someone who really understands what they're talking about. The investigator bias, that's one point. But even just the validity of arson science itself is debated. Fourthly, it struck the lawyers that investigators originally thought the fire was an accident, and that their initial impression was still the one that made the most sense. There were no signs of a struggle or violence, no unusual injuries that would tell them that the boys could have been smothered or strangled. We know the children had a history of playing with fire, and there wasn't really anything to explain why on that night Mr. Yebes would suddenly commit such a horrific crime. The pieces of evidence used by the experts were questionable, and basically at this point, everything else pointed to a horrible accident. On November 5th, 2020, so just a,
recent.
Yeah, very recent. An order came down from the Minister of Justice and Attorney General. After reviewing the application, it was determined that there was reasonable basis to conclude that a miscarriage of justice had likely occurred in this matter, and they ordered a new trial. It was set for the following week. This must have been so nerve-wracking, going to trial again, like 30 years later.
Yeah, but he is Tarek this time. Tarek's there.
This time he's got Tarek, and he's got the Innocence Project on his side, and Mr. Yebes was found not guilty on both counts.
I mean, fine a freaking Lee, obviously.
Yeah, his name is cleared now. Here's a quote from his lawyer after the court case. Mr. Yebes has led a positive and productive life since his release from custody. His two daughters, just children when their brothers died, have always believed in his innocence. For 37 years, Mr. Yebes has lived under the shadow of the stigma of the most terrible of crimes, murder of his own children. And after the verdict, Mr. Yebes said, "Thank you all." He had tears welling up in his eyes, his voice was cracking, and he was wheeled out of the courtroom in a wheelchair because his health was kind of shaky. He said, "Thank you all. I'm very grateful to so many people who put in so much time to correct the mistakes that were made before. That's all I have to say now, that I'm very hopeful and thankful. I have waited a long time. Thank you. Thank you. I never expected it, and I can't believe it." So Mr. Yebes is now free, and he is considered an innocent man. I internet stalked him, and I found out that he's an artist, and so right now he runs a little gallery, and you can see it online. And I would love to know how the rest of the family is doing, but I think they're a little more private. I definitely couldn't find anything about Elvira. I think I might have found his daughters, and they're just living their best lives. I think one's a photographer. So I'm really glad to hear that Mr. Yebes is happy now. I think he's remarried. And he's doing his art. I just can't imagine living 37 years under that shadow of being labeled a child killer after losing your very own children.
That's terrible. I wonder if you get any compensation or for years lost.
I want to find that out too. Maybe we'll do a little more digging and do like a post-case update. So all in all, they couldn't prove he did it. There was more evidence now to the contrary. There's more evidence to say that he didn't do it. And I'm happy with that verdict. I feel like kids play with fire, just like those boys did. When I used to live in East Van, my house nearly burned down.
I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So there was a little kid that lived upstairs, and we affectionately called him Pilaf. And Pilaf was playing with fire on his parents' bed, and it just went up. And it, got to the curtains, and the whole upstairs was pretty ravaged. And then we were soaked with water downstairs.
Pilaf, you little narc.
And so if you look today at mattresses, pillows, kids' pajamas, they'll say non-flammable. It's kind of weird. Why would they be flammable? But things that, as they mentioned, mattresses used to be made of, and couches, they used to be very flammable. Okay, palate cleanser time. Yeah, this case was heavy, but it's sunny out now, so I'm going to go get my hands dirty in the garden. Nene, what you gonna do?
I'm probably gonna fix myself a margarita.
Let me in on that. Sorry to love you and leave you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Whoopers.
You see, well, did you know that we pay for our episodes remain easily for you?
I love that. It was no sense. Why is there a kernel now? I thought it was out. Okay, you know what? I feel like I just have to pause and finish it tomorrow.
Sure. That sounds great. I'm glad.
But you're going to be on a cliffhanger.
Me? I know. I haven't been to bed thinking about those.
Who done it?
Elvira. Elvira did it, and she had her voodoo ways, for sure.
So in general, the Not to mention, in general, arson science...
You sound Spanish.
How is it validity? Why is it so hard?
Validity.